hey, hey. Welcome to a very special Corner Spatey event. It is myself, Nick, and I am joined with three very special guests. I need to take my phone out to introduce them because I don't want to get anything wrong with the introductions that I got from you guys. To the left of me, we'll go this way. Tufiq Haddad, a Palestinian-American academic and author. He holds a PhD in development studies from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, and the author of Palestinian Limited, Neoliberalism and Nationalism in the Occupied Territory, published in 2016. He has worked in various capacities across the occupied Palestinian territories as a journalist, researcher, consultant, editor, and publisher. He has recently directed the Council for British Research in the Levant's Jerusalem branch, the Kenyan Institute, from 2020 to 2024, and is currently a research fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies for the Humanities at the University of Edinburgh. Everyone give a big hand for him, because he came in town for this event. If you have been on your cell phone at all the past 3 years, then our next guest is no stranger to you, at least, you know, not to your TikTok account, at least. Lucas Ferbero, BDS activist and good friend of the show. Thank you for being on. And a big round of applause for him, too. And last but certainly not least, Rosa Gary Perez. You just said activist, and I'll keep it at that in order to keep us safe. Big round of applause for Rosa as well. So I'm going to put you then immediately on the spot after just introducing you last. Your primary work is dealing within, you know, the legal apparatus of the German state, particularly regarding Palestine activism and such. And I guess one of the main things that then I've constantly you published, you didn't publish, but there was a recent ruling that then kind of struck me as this typical attitude of Germany for all of those who were at the Palestine Congress 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I can't remember. Yeah, you know, in the past, that was immediately taken down by the German police in a quite brutal fashion. If anyone was there, you would remember that the cops came in, they broke into the powers room and, you know, shut the whole thing off. Also seemed quite, the police, you know, utilized that force, I would also assume, because the owner of the establishment was not a white German. But that's just me speculating. And then a few weeks ago, we see that then that this has been declared as then, oh, you know, what the police did was illegal. How is then the process of Germany in this kind of back and forth of, you know, the state doing something, you know, state apparatus doing something illegal, and then the state coming back and being like, oh, well, actually, that wasn't okay. Has this transformed over the time of, you know, post October 7th? Unfortunately, we have to use that as our date, but yeah.
So we are seeing these cases now. It's not only the Palestine Congress, which was declared like the closing of the Palestine Congress was declared illegal. It's also the when they banned Ghassan Abu Sitta for entering Germany. That also was a trial, and it was also illegal to deny him entry. And I guess Varoufakis as well, but I don't know if Varoufakis has been in trial. Hasn't been in that trial. For the rest of the stuff, it's not really happening. Like, we have a lot of trials about what is about the students, the slogans, and the demos, and we are winning many, but still the judicial system, even though we are winning many, is not saying, like, stop bringing these cases. Like, even we have won many, many cases, or, for example, from the river to the sea, we won many cases, like, in the first instance, and still the Staatsanwaltschaft, the prosecutor office, is still fighting it and taking it to the next one and to the next one. And yeah, they are not backing down, so to say. So there is not much like backing down, although we win. So I don't know how to explain it.
Do you find that there's a difference between like the state of Berlin level and then the federal level, or do these cases never reach a federal level? Do they constantly remain internally within these, you know, legal systems within the state of, or I guess what, the state of Berlin-Brandenburg technically would be, right? Or is there things, because there's also the, and we'll talk about this then further with Lucas as well, the passing of certain legislation, you know, the end, like, for example, banning phrases, this and that and that. And as you've mentioned, they kind of like come back into this ricochet sort of effect of that then the state will do something, it gets, you know, challenged, and then we then see this kind of come back in this never-ending cycle. Is it strictly then left on the Berlin level, or do we see it then on other levels too?
So for now it has been in the Berlin level. From what I know, it has been in the Berlin level. This banning from the river to the sea, that is especially bad in Berlin. It's not everywhere in Germany. Like, I heard so many other places, like in Frankfurt, they can say it and nothing happens. This is in other places too, but it's a very Berliner thing. And until now, we are in Berlin level. We haven't got to the next one. Okay. We did lose one in the Landesgericht, and that one is going up in these different courts that are, don't ask me, I get lost. And at one point, it's going to have to go up in the, like, Berlin-Brandenburg, and then at one point, it has to go to the constitutional level. Mm-hmm. That's, like, the end of it.
Do you feel that then Berlin might be, like, kept as an example because the movement is larger here, or because there's more Palestinians here that then are active? Or is there a particular reason why then Berlin has remained a focal? Or is it just simply in the natural fact that Berlin's the capital?
I think it has to do with Berlin is the capital, and they want to show that Germany is fighting anti-Semitism. And, like, for the people listening, I'm doing... I think it's that, and I also think that the mayor, the Burgermeister, is really into this idea that everything that has to do with Palestine is anti-Semitic, and therefore it has to be fought with all the force. I think it's, yeah, and for me, it's crazy because they are trying to make an example of Berlin, but they don't realize how bad it looks to the rest of the world when the Berlin police attack us. Like, the rest of the world, at least in Spain, they're like looking at us and they're saying, what the fuck are they doing?
Oh, there's one. You mentioned that you're only allowed two bad words.
Per hour. Yeah.
So for those keeping track at home, that is one swear from Rosa.
Yeah, if not, it goes to the yard. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they want to do, like, for example, they're crazy dead on no cufillas, like passing the Brandenburger Tor, because of what it will symbolize or something. But then they have the Israeli flag in the Brandenburger Tor. So I think it's like they want to say that Berlin is pro-Israel, and all the Palestinians that live here, they are all, I don't know, I guess for them they are terrorists, for me no, que quede claro. But they want to make an example, and it's just, I don't know, it's insulting. And Berlin is by far the state in Germany that has the most cases against pro-Palestinians. We also have many, many demonstrations, that is true. Mm-hmm. But the Berlin police has been especially violent with us, and like with all these violence cases.
That brings me then, I guess, my next point that I wanted to ask is then, what are the mechanisms that then are, like, you know, the extrajudicial mechanisms that we've seen? You mentioned police violence, which I'm pretty sure everyone in this room has either witnessed or personally been affected with. But we've also seen then extra steps in the sense of people's houses being raided. And what is then the justification for the state then on these measures? Because I know that then we can always like go into the sense of, oh, it's because they're Palestinian activists. But like, what is the justification that then that is constantly brought up in like a legal parameter that the state says that they have to do these? I mean, police brutality is, I guess, extremely extrajudicial, but in the sense of raids and what's the English word for Überwachung? Surveillance. And things of this matter. How does then the state kind of go about trying to then convince itself that this is a legal, acceptable method to then do something within a country. Then, if I'm not mistaken, we're now technically like a crippled democracy or whatever, according to Amnesty or whoever it is. Does anyone know?
Civicus.
Yeah.
Obstructed democracy.
That's it. Yes.
The legal steps, I don't know. Like, the justification is like, we are doing all this anti-Semitic stuff and we might be terrorists. Like, From the River to the Sea is propaganda for a terrorist organization. So that's how they go on about. And about the house raids, I don't know how much I can say. Like, some of them is like because they think people are involved in something. And then other things that I'd rather not say.
Okay.
But the legal justification is not even like, for me, it's paralegal. And this is not like, I'm not a lawyer. For me, it's paralegal because they are like, oh, From the River to the Sea is forbidden. It is not. The Innen Ministerium say From the River to the Sea is forbidden because it's propaganda from a terrorist organization. But it hasn't been like established that it's terrorist propaganda from a terrorist organization. That's why we are still on trial, because it is not a law. It is, until now, not really forbidden. But the police act as it is. So what they do is like they assume that it is a straftat, it's a crime, and they act as if we are committing a crime. You know, that's and a little bit.
Yeah, and so it just like ends up as we were mentioning, that constant, you know, rigmarole of the quasi legal status that then it exists in, never really coming to an end, because the state can just be like, oh well, actually, it is a terrorism thing or whatever, even though it isn't like legally as what.
Yeah, and one thing I have to say is like, because they act this way and they are like, oh, we are arresting all these people, and of course the German media is rotten and is going with it and is saying like how dangerous we are and all these clans and all these terrorist people, then sometimes the German media actually points at activists and say they are very dangerous people because they have been arrested a few times from the River to the Sea or Jala Jala Intifada or whatever the arrest was. And then they got raids in their house. But it's like, it's a circle. The police act in a illegal way, and then they get arrested, and then the German media records it, and then the politicians and the German and the police is like, look, it's in the German media, they are so dangerous. So then they go to their houses, and then it gets reported, and we are in this Teufelkreis, in this circle of evil, where these people, and many of them, have not been convicted for any crime, and still they are pointed out as dangerous criminals. So it's like, I don't know, for me it's like a paralegal where, like, at the end, many courts, they say they are not guilty. So they suffer years, some of them like now 2 years of pointing at them, and then the day in court, not guilty.
So it just strictly functions as an intimidation tactic then?
Yes, yeah. And not only intimidation, like it's an intimidation, and also they want to tell to the people, look, if you speak up for Palestine, it's dangerous. So I think it's more a show where they are like players, and then the Staatsgason is saying, look what happens to you if you speak up for Palestine. And it's not like, it's not about defending Israel, it's about like, yeah, if you speak up for Palestine, because if they wanted to defend Israel, there were better ways.
Yeah, I think that that's like something that, even with having some level of distance from the movement, I think someone can even like see that. I guess it would be a good point to then turn to you, Torek, of what does then Germany look like to someone who does not live here, and especially as someone who's Palestinian, of then... Surely you're aware of then the police repressions and stuff like that. But how does it look to then someone who's outside of the country seeing this? Now, the UK is maybe the worst example because they've also criminalized Palestine Action for terrorist activities. I'm also doing air quotes to the listener at home. But how does Germany then look in the comparison to then like the rest of the European Union? Or is just like the EU as a whole is just seen as like a kind of insane quagmire of, you know, the in like this false fight against anti-Semitism or whatever it may be?
Well, I I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. It's not just what it looks like, it's what it is. And what it is one of the key states that backed the genocide. I mean, by the end of it, after 2 years, end with in quotation marks, or where we got to just when it took a temporary pause in October, or at least changed forms, the genocide was basically being backed by four countries, key countries, the US, Great Britain, Germany, and Israel. And I mean, the way the German, what was just described and the way what you're asking sort of connotes or I guess signifies the extent to which, well, I think outsiders looked at what happened as sort of the height of hypocrisy in terms of these are the sort of, you know, the folks who advocated that, you know, they're the West and they're into democracy and liberal values and the Enlightenment and all that kind of stuff. And they use all those tropes to, you know, tropes against the Arabs and against, you know, non-Westerners to say that, you know, everybody sort of has to, that everyone else is so uncivilized and they're so civilized. But we saw how fast they were willing to throw away, you know, basic tenets of the liberal playbook, let's say. And I think the big question that comes out of that is why? And I mean, that's not what you're asking right now.
Oh, no, but I think that that's a great point of that. Then I mean, even myself of living in this country, I do find myself sometimes forgetting that then this is one of the largest military partners to Israel. I know that sounds silly to forget that because it's a very obvious thing. Second largest. Number one is the United States, right? God, I hate being American. But yeah, that there is, it is this thing too. I guess maybe it's from a, you know, like personal involvement within the movement and this and that, that there is always this kind of general, I don't want to say forgetfulness because that's not true at all, but there is just kind of this thing of the inability to understand sometimes just the vast support that Germany as a state has to Israel, because yes, we see the death and destruction and this and that, but we're not seeing, you know, Rheinmetall written on like, you know, the side of a, you know, missile that then hits, you know, a house or innocent people in Palestine. It's, you know, strictly the sense of that then we see Rheinmetall, for example, stocks going up quite quickly and this and that and that. And it's pretty easy to like, you know, not remove it, but just kind of turn it into data more so in the fact of rather than the sense of that this country is a deathly partner to this. And yeah, I mean, and I guess then too as well, asking in that sense of, you know, you're in Edinburgh, you said as well. And, the attitudes in the United Kingdom too have also then been quite criminalized, but is then it to a similar extent, I guess, than to Germany's, or is it just a complete different tactic as in the, you know, that the UK is functioning through this like hyper illegalization of something. And we're then seeing then people trying to then be intimidated that way.
Yeah, I think it's quite equivalent. It's quite consistent across the Western Hemisphere, and certainly within those key states I mentioned. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, because they're key partners in the Western strategy. And when we talk about Germany being the second largest supplier of weapons to Israel, that's a function of a policy. It's a function of an attitude, a strategy. And that's what needs to be talked about, not just the fact that these weapons go. It's the strategy. It's the politics. And that's what we need to be working on to break down.
I guess then just quickly then turning to Lucas as well, because speaking of strategies to then try to do what we can to then dismantle the oppressive measures of Israel. As I mentioned earlier, you're a BDS activist. And how have then you seen this transform since your time then involved within the movement? Of course, it's been, you know, post October 7th. We had you on the show a few months ago to talk about then strategies, the small wins and stuff like that. But what have then been the effective measures that then that have been kind of taken on by BDS in order to, you know, do something from a, you know, consumption level of things, but still quite effective to some degree?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm quite new to this specifically, to BDS activism. So I kind of don't know firsthand how it was to be really intensely active in that on a daily basis. But I know from just looking at what has happened in the past 2+ years, and also obviously from knowing a lot of people who have been doing this for a lot longer than I have, that we're living in a completely different world. And to be honest with you, it's always a bit anxiety inducing for me when someone asks me, like on the spot, like what are the BDS wins that have happened in the recent past? No. I knew it was coming, but and I feel anxious about it, not because there's like not a lot to talk about, but because I'm afraid that I'm certain that I'm going to miss a bunch of stuff, you know, and then I'm not going to do it justice. I mean, there are, you know, student groups pressuring their universities left and right to cut ties with Israeli institutions, and succeeding in doing so in a lot of cases, also faculty, of course. In the cultural sphere, there's so much going on. I mean, we saw what happened at the Vuelta last year. We all see what's happening with Eurovision at the moment. Eurovision eventually is just going to be Germany and Israel, and Israel wins by default because the Germans.
Germany could Israel never schools. Send a good act. Like, let us be clear.
We had early on in the genocide, Puma leaving as a sponsor of the Israel Football Association. Within the boycott area, I mean, Puma is one such case. There was a boycott call against them, but there are boycott targets suffering severely all over the world due to boycotts, including massive companies. Intel canceled the biggest ever planned investment in Israel, like an investment, I think it was $25 billion for a new chip production plant in Israel that was scrapped in 2024. So the Visualizing Palestine actually recently launched a platform called The Growth of a Movement that tries to, well, to make it visual, essentially, how the movement has grown since the original BDS call in 2005. I was looking at it today, incidentally, and you can see the graph just like shooting up for the past couple of years. So there's a lot happening. Like Israel is a rogue state, you know, at this point. And they will say it themselves. Sometimes it's buried in, the headlines in Hebrew. You don't necessarily see it in Western media. I think it was Ilan Pape who said that Zionists think that Hebrew is a secret language or something like that.
Yeah, when you hit translate on Twitter.
Well, there's that, but there's also but there's also just like them being very, very candid about how badly they're doing in Israeli media. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a group of top Israeli economists that sent a letter to the prime minister saying that the economy is in a spiral of collapse. Their terms, a spiral of collapse. Of course, superficially, if you look at the Israeli economy, it doesn't seem to be doing too badly if you look at the stock market, but structurally it's doing very, very poorly. Young, educated people are leaving in droves. So the long-term outlook for the Israeli economy is not very good at all. And that's due to BDS, first and foremost. That's due to the millions of people who have engaged in BDS activism throughout the world, in Europe, and also in Germany. Of course, it's very much an uphill battle in a place like Germany. But even here, you know, you have campaigns against Elbit, against Allianz. So everywhere, people are campaigning to end complicity in the genocide.
I guess then, just kind of to open up, if anyone that wants to add to this, you mentioned the sense of Israel being a rogue state, and I think that that kind of puts things into a very interesting perspective now that we're, of course, seeing the United States behaving in a much more erratic way. Is there, I know that then I had this, the title of this talk be, you know, Germany, where do we stand? But is there a possibility that then that Europe as a kind of general thing, you know, entity sees that, and that we see, I mean, we've seen some pushback from certain countries like Spain to a very small degree. And you mentioned Eurovision, where, you know, a few of the national broadcasters then pulled back. But is the coupling within the United States also becoming more rogue, possibly going to like change something? Or is it that the West is simply too deep in this? That Israel's support, as you mentioned, is tied to then liberal democratic values. Is there a possibility of a fissure happening due to then this you know, behavior that then that Israel coupled with then its massive support from the United States has?
I think what we witnessed in the genocide was that the West was willing to undermine its own values to be able to continue the genocide. And that was very clear. And that was the hypocrisy that I spoke of. So the question whether there's a possibility for a fissure to happen, well, I think there is. I mean, that's the whole basis of our activism. But that comes from a belief that we can build one. But what if we're talking objectively right now about the state of the world and the state of states themselves and the political class who are running the show right now, they're doubling down on Israel, and that's what this is all about, and that's why they're willing to undermine. A good part of my research has to do with how that arose and why that arose. And I think basically we can sort of, Israel was always a rogue state.
Yeah, of course.
There's no question about that from the very beginning. It's founded on ethnic cleansing, and literally everything it did in the genocide, it did before, but it just did it to huge scale and did it in a way that where what we call in legal terms, plausible deniability was no longer possible. Everybody in the world witnessed it. Everyone documented it. And there was, you know, there was no way to deny it. Basically, the top scholars of genocide all came around and said, "It's a genocide." So, like I said, the main thing has to do with, you know, why that took place, and I think we can trace it back to basically the collapse of liberalism itself, where we are today in world history and geopolitics, basically, going back particularly to the 2008 financial crisis. Which, had it allowed to play itself out, would have led to a world economy that would have looked a lot more like the 1930s. Instead, what we had, like, you know, we witnessed from the 1980s onwards sort of neoliberalism on steroids, and particularly after 1990, when the West was the unipolar power, they tried to lock in to the world system, the Western and the U.S. unipolar rules-based order, basically, or rules, their vision for the rules of the world. And they're not willing to see the UN be used now as a site where China and the rest of the world can fight back. They had to compromise after World War II because the Allies had the Soviet Union. But after 1990, that didn't exist. And so the West tried to lock in that system. When 2008 happened, as I said, though, you had this major economic collapse. They printed all this money. They bought up all the toxic debt. But the point of that was that the real point here was that ideologically, there was no longer neoliberalism failed. It collapsed. It went off a cliff. So there was no theory guiding how the world economy was to act. It was about politics. Why did Goldman Sachs survive but Bear Stearns collapse? They were all doing the same thing. That basically meant that insiders were running the system. And with the rise of China, with the rise of the BRICS, with the decline of Western competitiveness in the last particularly 20 years, there's clearly an anxiety that is emerging and consternation amongst these forces that they're losing the position that they used to have. And that's why you see the rise of forms of populism, the rise of new forms of imperialism not based just on rules-based order like post-World War II, but imperialism, the old sense of grab Greenland, grab Panama, grab Venezuela, grab, you know, let Israel do the genocide, etc. And then really, particularly when we bring it back to Israel-Palestine, the key thing here, of course, is that the peace process, quote-unquote peace process, allowed Israel to globalize its brand, to clean its rogue state status for the past 30 years, and to integrate globally and expand globally, and particularly to become a key player in Western geopolitics and Western economic futures for its economic revivalism in its competitiveness and in its attempt to manage the crisis that it is trying to figure out economically because of the collapse of neoliberalism and geostrategically because of the rise of China. And that's what we're witnessing. And so Israel's playing this key role in that, in the hydrocarbon question, in the weapons question, in the cyber question. The cyber question, I don't think you guys realize, we're talking about everybody's online today. Capitalism is online. So who is, we? It's not like back in the day you needed military forces. You needed to defend whatever, you know, actual access to goods or whatnot. If everything is happening online, cyber is where the warfare takes place, and Israel is the military for that. So Israel is basically a global military for global Western capitalism, and that's why there's these big technological wars, and that's why Israel is so key to the Western plans. And that's why the West is willing to undermine its own liberal values, because liberalism already collapsed. And in the chaos that has emerged, that's where Israel needs to be normalized and forget about free speech, forget about right to organize, forget about, you know, right to unionize, all the basic liberal values. Those are out the window, because anyway, the whole system is gone, and we need to be much more robust and militaristic, because we don't want to be a sucker in this new era coming up.
That definitely deserves a whoop. Yeah, absolutely. That is a perfect point. The cybersecurity aspect of Israel, especially when then it faces domestic European countries, I think is also a very interesting thing to maybe ask you, Roser, about. Israel is one of the largest exporters of cybersecurity to law enforcement, particularly like in the United States, Germany, and such. Has there then been a... It's one of these things that I guess Germany keeps very under wraps, but has there then been a you know, possible noticeable change within the sense of this... you know, implementations of things like Pegasus and things like this? Has the German state been able to then utilize the technologies that then are sold from Israel to a lot of, you know, local governments or even local municipalities? Or is this something that then is a bit hard to grasp within the, you know, legal apparatus of the German state when they're, you know, attacking activists?
So I know they wanted to use Pegasus in one state. I don't remember which one. But I'm pretty sure they want to use it. I mean, it's wonderful. Now with this new law, this new thing they want to do with the police, that they can go into your house without the judge signing or anything. The police can decide you are a person of interest, and they can go in and install all these programs. I don't think these programs are being to be coded in Costa Rica. I mean, they come from Israel, no? So yeah, I mean, that's why it's a main partner. And it's not only here. Like, I was reading today, the community of Madrid, the woman that is running the community of Madrid, she's very right wing. She's horrible. She's like a woman Trump. And she's also making deals with Israel, so it's going to be everywhere. So that's why Israel is interesting to all these people to control us. Yeah. I was going to say that also, like, Israel is suffering the boycotts and everything, but I have to add that genocide is expensive. Like, it is expensive, so that's why also the economy is not doing so well, no? It has to play a part, or, like...
Yes, it's expensive. Of course, it helps when you get, like, a big fat check from the United States every year, and also you get weapons, not just... You don't just buy weapons, but they're given to you as well. But it also, because Israel is a Sparta, essentially, that what they're really good at doing is stuff that oppresses, controls, and kills people. So there's a big boom, you know, in companies like Rafael, Elbit, because the business has been great for them. Not only with the genocide, but also with deals that they close. And that includes, you know, the cyber warfare and surveillance companies like the NSO group that makes Pegasus and all that as well. But again, these are like, these are things that are driven by the killing of Palestinians itself. You know, it's not a sign of a healthy, robust economy in the long term. And even the prime minister himself, Netanyahu, like I use Sparta came to mind because that's a word that he used in a recent speech. He said that we have to become a new Sparta, essentially, because we can't rely on the world anymore, because he knows that there are pariah states and that BDS is working, so that they need to be able to rely completely on themselves, which is an absolute fever dream that he has. Israel is not able to do that. It's a tiny country. It doesn't have a lot of, it needs to import a lot of things. But it just goes to show like the level of desperation, essentially, you know. I also wanted to add really quickly on your point.
Go for it.
I think that, you know, it's an argument to be made that if Europe is to stop being complicit in this genocide, not just the genocide, but the apartheid, the settler colonial regime, etc. The first step is ceasing to become a vassal of the United States, because the United States and Israel are one, essentially, for intents and purposes. So what we're seeing now, the return of naked, unapologetic imperialism by the United States, is also, it presents an opportunity for that to happen, for that break to happen. Of course, there's unprecedented tension happening right now between the US and Europe. Of course, it's also true that European leaders remain much too coy, and not to say subservient, even with the threat of like just a land grab with Greenland, which of course has its own people, etc. But the fact of the matter is they're citizens of the European Union, and still normally a part of Denmark. And it goes back to the importance of building intersectional alliances as well, I think, which is a core thing of what BDS is about. Petro, the president of Colombia, said last year something along the lines of Gaza is the experiment. It starts with Gaza and is going to come for all of us. That's a hell of a prophecy, you know, because I didn't think that mere months after that, the US would have kidnapped a sitting president, neighboring his own country, and also be threatening him with the same fate. So it just goes to show that yes, Gaza was an experiment. It was a laboratory for a new type of world order, essentially. And all of us are at threat. All of us in Latin America, in the global South in general. But also Europe, you know, it might not stop even there.
Yeah.
So if nothing else, and it should have been a lot of other things, but if nothing else, out of self-preservation, European leaders at some point need to wake up.
I think that's an interesting point that you bring up about the laboratory aspect, that this isn't just a solely thing that then has happened with Gaza, but this is the modern example, that then it does seem to me that there's always this like kind of like Fukuyamaist view of the world, that people think that then all these examples of imperialist laboratories have just remained in the past. You know, we have Indonesia as a good example. Latin America as a whole during the 60s to 80s is one of just, you know, how the United States is doing things covertly. But I think that that's maybe that's something that then that you could elaborate on, of then how specifically then has then the action, like you mentioned, like one of your pieces, your book about neoliberalism in Palestine. Surely then that this is also not, I mean, there's of course the absurd violence of it, of course, that we see within the genocide. But how other aspects have Palestinians kind of then been within this neoliberal laboratory for the state of Israel, this rogue state that then is constantly, because surely it also is like not only just militarily, but economically, land seizures, all these other things are just another aspect of then the imperial apparatus that then Israel exists in, right?
I mean, at the beginning of the peace process, there was this vision that the Middle East would be a new NAFTA. But if you look back, this vision that Trump talks about turning it into a Riviera, they used to talk about Gaza being the next Singapore or Hong Kong or you know, some sort of, you know, robust economic actor on the Middle East, on the Mediterranean. And that, you know, that because that comes out of the fact that Gaza is actually located in a pretty key geostrategic location. I mean, it's at the, you know, the connecting point between the two largest continents of the world. It's also across the key. You have the North African trade route, and you have the trade route that comes up from the Hejaz all the way up to the Levant. So it's a key fulcrum in this sort of this corner where basically east, if you want to go east to west, basically you've got to go through the Suez Canal. This region, there's a major battle taking place between the east and the west, and who gets to control these middle grounds. That's what Russia and Ukraine is about, and that's what Gaza, Israel, Palestine is about. And what I didn't get a chance to say in my previous answer is it's not so much that there's some sort of like laboratory going on about neoliberalism. I mean, you can think of it that way. It might be helpful. But there are real plans, and the real plan actually announced a month before October 7th happened under Biden was that basically America's plan for pushing back China and its quote-unquote Western encroachment. You know, we know China has the sort of Belt and Road Project, and it also has a maritime equivalent of this. And America lost its ability to sort of basically, and under Trump and in general, like after Afghanistan and Iraq, there was less appetite for being militarily active in the region. So it became more dependent upon Israel. But and that led to, quote unquote, the kind of encroachment of Turkey as well as Iran, as well as political Islam as a potential force and a potential threat to Western dominance in that region. So the big American slash Western plan for reorganizing that collapse and those organizing those contradictions, those that complex situation, was basically to set up what they called the India-Israel sort of strategic corridor, okay, where basically India would become the new production site, keep China at bay eastward, and it would go all trade, and what you would have this new strategic corridor developing between India, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel. Israel would be the spigot that feeds Europe. It would be the security guarantor. It would provide a lot of the technology, and the Indians would provide the labor as well as the production, and all of that would be used to reorganize the political and economic linkages in the region to give a project for their allies in that region, that key strategic wedge of the globe, basically. And that's why even in the genocide, when they first started coming out with the Gaza Riviera stuff, there was that leak that came out, which first announced it, and there was sort of like a 39-page PowerPoint presentation, which basically talked about what I said and elaborated upon it. But it gave some pretty interesting details, speaking about things like Saudi Arabia not just being a key provider of energy, but also having rare minerals in it. And they wanted to set up in the region of Gaza a kind of factory that would develop electronic batteries for Elon Musk, and that would feed the Western market and keep Chinese electric cars out of the Western market, and transportation is key. So that sort of indicates the larger, it's not, you see, the larger geopolitical sort of chess game that's going on here.
I think that that's a very good way of putting it. I mean, especially too in the sense of, I mean, I don't want to do the explicitly Marxist thing that everything comes down to the economy, but I mean, it does also then seem too that then Germany's interests are then, as you've mentioned, that then that Germany and the rest of Europe will be a dire ally to Israel until the day that Israel may not exist anymore, because of then this level of economic powerhouse that then that this region can provide. And I think it's also too good to then bring up how You know, we've seen Syria as well now come under, you know, U.S. Israel influence as such. There is, of course, the big question in the room of what happens in Iran as well, too. Kind of on the flip side, has there been then, you know, you mentioned Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia. Has there then been pushback from then the global south in any way other than mostly just words? They don't necessarily have the economic capital invested in the region to then do big plays, except for China, who hasn't. So has there been a resistance then that we see from then these quite vocal countries? I think Colombia, if I'm not mistaken, has like stopped exporting, was it oil to Israel or something like that? I can't remember exactly.
Coal,
that's what it was, yeah. What have the pushbacks then been from the non-Western countries?
I don't think there's been significant from the existing states. I mean, at the end of the day, you do have, though, a region that is not disciplined enough. It's run through dictators. The West was brutally reminded of the fact that even if they have strong men who are their allies in Tunisia and Egypt and wherever, in a day and a night, they can go. So, you know, and it's not just out of a love for Israel per se, but they don't have allies in the region, reliable allies. Israel is organically linked to the West. It needs a Western, sort of father figure, empire protector, basically. And that the Western umbrella provides that. But the Arab world is a lot of too many question marks around it. You know, there's a strong Arab national political history to it. There's a resurgent Islamist one that's going on. Iran is a powerful state. Turkey is a powerful state. If they don't have a key ally in the region, somebody else will. The vacuum will be filled. So that's why they don't care.
Yeah, just to add as well, of course, especially after 2+ years of live stream genocides, you would hope to see a bit more movement and unity, especially in the global south, to kind of push back against it. Having said that, you do see a lot of countries and governments taking meaningful steps. You mentioned one example in Colombia is a very, in general, good positive example. So the ban on coal exports, and I mean the announcement of the ban, and then there was a loophole that was being exploited, and then Pedro worked to close that loophole as well, which is important because sometimes what it says on the press release or on speeches doesn't necessarily correspond to the reality. So it's important to note that they have followed through with the implementation of that. You also see countries canceling deals and imposing, or at least announcing the intention to impose, military embargoes against Israel. Brazil is an example. Countries in the Caribbean who flag a lot of cargo ships, withdrawing their flags when it's established that they're carrying military material to Israel. But of course, you want to see something more coordinated, something that is a bit more systemic than these more or less piecemeal, even if significant, piecemeal kind of initiatives. Which brings me to the Hay Group, which is a group, I won't remember the list of states now, but I think it might be close to 10 states that started this group in The Hague a year ago. South Africa was one of them, a few states in Latin America, Caribbean states, and they met in Bogota last year as well, later on, with more countries involved. That was an attempt essentially to do what I just said, to kind of like join forces to try to coordinate meaningful responses, you know? Of course, it has been slow, and the implementation of the proposed initiatives sometimes run into snags, especially when you're talking about multiple countries with their own legislations. And of course, there's also the turnover in leadership as well, which happens when dictatorships are toppled, but also in the when people are just voted out of power. So there's all that. There's a lot of challenges, but I think that's what we need to see more of. You know, we need to see more unity in the global South right now. So that countries are not, because, you know, if they try to fight these battles alone, the odds are stacked against them, you know? But if they join forces, then you can start seeing some meaningful movement.
Okay. I know that I said that the discussion was going to be about Germany, and we've now ended up on the entire geopolitics of Israel, which I appreciate. I assume that everyone in the room also has very much enjoyed the discussion. Before we then open it up to questions, I want to then ask, this is going to sound like a stupid question, but just in the sake of then, you know, the talk, you know, just to each person individually, where do we go from here then? Because it seems like from every aspect, this is a massive battle forward in any which way that you the feeling of going up against the global order definitely feels daunting. But you know, for us then as the individuals that we are kind of observing this and you know, being entirely disgusted with it, what is a way forward whenever, and this is entirely your own personal, you know, input on that, because it's incredibly interesting, of course, to then hear how this stuff has all developed over the years, over the you know, 70 plus years of Israel's very bloody existence. But in some degree, it just kind of seems like that then this is going to just chug along until just something doesn't exist anymore, whether it be Western neoliberal order, whether it be the United States in its current sense, whether it be the state of Israel, which I don't think I can legally say that in this country, but asterisk. This is strictly for an academic reason of asking that question. So yeah, if I just, whoever wants to start, I guess. Rosa, you can go.
Yeah, yes. And I bring it back to Germany.
Thank you. Yeah. We did it.
Yeah. Palestine is the laboratory of Israel, at least in what weapons is. Like, they can also sell them like tested in battle. There are documentaries about it. And I think the pro-Palestine movement in Germany is also the laboratory of Germany. I think Germany is seeing how far they can go with us, with the violence on the street, with the court cases, with trying to deport people that have passports. They are trying. They are testing the limits on when the white majority of, let's say, white Germans will actually say this is too much. Like, I don't care how anti-Semitic, I'm doing again quote marks, I don't care how anti-Semitic and terroristic these people are, this is too much for us. And so far they kind of don't understand that it's coming for them after, like, we are the tryout, and then when we are, like, I don't know, repressed and gone, they will not end with us. Like, that's why they are also buying surveillance stuff from Israel.
Well, there was something really interesting. Sorry to interrupt really quick, yeah. But the combination of then, like, Germany ending up with the, like, French phrase of, like, Islamo-gauchism, of, like, that there is, like, you know, Islamic leftism, which would, at the time when I first heard, was it Nancy Fraser, who was the interior minister from the SPD, using that phrase during a press conference? I was like, oh, it's over. You know, she used the phrase is Islamo-leftism to just, it was after the Palestine Congress, in order for then the German, you know, in order for then this to make it palatable to the German people, that no, we have to use all these extrajudicial measures. It's because the Islamists and the leftists have, like, you know, combined forces, which has been something that they've been saying in France for like 20 years now. And that's very, like, you know, when you mention the sense of that, then it's like, this is the first group. And I mean, Palantir now has a contract in Baden-Württemberg, a, you know, very terroristic state. I think that's a phenomenal point to bring up, that then it's like, no matter who you are within, like, as long, like, if you don't fit within the realm of the neoliberal project that we are currently decaying in Germany, you might be next on the chopping block.
They are like, and they are changing the language, because at the beginning it was like all these Islamists, and I don't know they know what Islam is, but they, like, they began with this Islamist and of course the far left, but now they are changing the language and they are not talking about the far left anymore, they are talking about leftist in general. So anything like that is not CDU is like leftist, and they are as dangerous as the rest of us. So they are like, it's shifting to a large portion of the population that is not like agreeing with the government right now. And they are all dangerous. And like, in my opinion, like most of the Germans have not wake up to how dangerous the situation right now is. And when I talk to them, to the German people, and I say, like, you don't know what we are seeing on the streets, and the, like, just the thought that they are this, that a few years ago there was this scandal about re-immigration, and like all these white people, they were on the streets, we are color, la 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 la. Well, re-immigration is happening. And nobody cares anymore, because they push this, that we are so dangerous, that they see it as maintaining the rule of law. So what it was far right a few years ago, it's kind of okay right now to maintain like Germany as it is and the rule of law. And this is thanks to the German press. Like, thank you, German press. You really did your job, propagandistic. Like, for me, what is the future is just to keep telling them, like, wake up now. We've been here before in this country, or you have been here before with this country. Wake up now, because they really go one after the other, and this time it's going to be easier. We all have a phone. They can, like, right now, it's just, you know, they can get into your phone. They get all your contacts, and it's going to be so easy to go after us if we don't unite now and react now. The moment is now. Not in a few years, yeah. Woo!
I said, I can't clap or else my microphone makes noises, but I was clapping. Who is brave enough to then, I guess, take my very terrible open question? But that was a phenomenal answer. I think that's truly something that the average German does not comprehend, because they think that, and the remigration aspect is absolutely terrifying and genuinely real. And I mean, recently now we have seen the AfD and the CDU try to make, given the CDU got mad about this, but they tried to make Turning Point Germany. Is anyone aware of this? Yeah, in NRW, the Jugendgruppe, Wendepunkt Deutschland. Yeah, they tried to make Turning Point Germany. And it is then now the woman from the CDU that then has like brought it up to then work with the AfD is like getting a slap on the wrist right now. But there is this possibility that you know, that the whatever was called the Brandmauer, that BS, that's down. You know, that's not a real thing. The far right and the right are definitely having their moment, and they're coming after then, I think, a general. Like, I don't want to sound like, you know, paranoid, but it seems, you know, with the usage of the German media, especially too, where I have to remember all the time that Tagesspiegel is not a part of Springer Verlag, even though it seems like they are. So, yeah, I think that's definitely something that then is going to make living in this country much more difficult within the massive Overton window that then has been pushed further and further and further to the right.
But it's not only the politicians. Like I was living here before so many years, and now it's been like 2 years. And before, like, I will discuss with friends and friends of friends about things that I didn't like about Germany, and you know, like, Germans don't like Germany. Now, when I discuss things about Germany, they actually tell to my face, if you don't like it, go back to your country. And this is normal. Like before, I think if I was in a round table and a German person tells to me, go back to your country if you don't like it here, at least somebody will say, like, what the fuck did you just say? What did you just say? Now it's like, yeah, you know, if you complain so much, if you don't like it, go back to Spain. You are so cool there. And it's like, well, you know, Spain. I don't know. So it's not only the politicians. Let's not blame just the politicians and the media. Like, the German society also is playing an important role in what is going on. And I think it's important, like, for the future to know, because now we have, like, at least growing up in Europe, you hear all these stories about the Nazis and the Germans, like kind of victims of the Nazis. I mean, they did, but they didn't know. And then they have to go after to the concentration camps because they didn't know. Now they cannot say they don't know. Like now, like the shit is on the table.
Wait. You're good.
Okay. So it is on the table. They cannot say they didn't know. Now they know, and they really need to act, like, and get... It's 2 hours, no? They can get their shit together.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes. We're technically past 1 hour, so you can say a second bad word. But now you're...
Papá me portó bien.
Yeah, no. You've used all of them up. I'm sorry.
Cool.
Okay. Where do we go from here? In a lot of ways, a complicated question, but it's in one way, I think it's also a very simple one. Well, first of all, I think if you want to engage in pro-Palestine activism in the most strategic, effective way, the two words that you need to keep in mind at all times is end complicity. That's what the BDS movement asks us to do. That's what Palestinian society represented in the BDS movements, the biggest coalition in Palestinian society. That's what they ask us to do. So I think if you take one thing away in that, on that side of things, is let that be the guiding principle of all of your activism, all of your personal actions, all of your organizing. And if you're already engaging in that, then just continue to do that. Now, how do you not lose the motivation to do that is the other part of the question in the face of everything that we're talking about. Look, there's no, I think that that's where you get into very emotional, personal aspects. I can only tell you what works for me. I always remember, it's two things I always remember when I talk about this. First of all is something that I heard Ilan Papes say when he came to Berlin a year and a half ago or so. And he gave a lecture, and at the end he took questions, and then inevitably in that type of setting, someone asked the question of, like, how do you not lose your mind and stay motivated to keep at it in the face of everything that's going on, especially in a country like Germany? And he said something along the lines of, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and it takes a while for you to internalize this feeling, because it's a feeling, it's not a thought, that you wake up every day and you never ask yourselves, like, what are the results of what I did yesterday or what I did last week? You just ask, can I do a bit more? Is there a little bit more than I can do today? That's the first thing. Then the second thing is, I remember a conversation that I had with my mom when I was back home in Brazil just a few months ago. And we were talking about Palestine, and she doesn't follow it very closely. She didn't know what BDS was. So I had to explain it to her, and
your mom doesn't know your job.
No, she does. She gets anxious, very, very easily. So, certain details that I have to withhold. But I was explaining it to her, and she said, you know, I'm proud of you. That's commendable, but I just don't see it happening, you know? And BDS, let's not forget, is inspired by the global solidarity movement that helped end apartheid in another instance in South Africa. And it was instrumental in ending that regime there. And I told her that, and I asked her back in the 70s, you know, 60s or 70s, did you ever think that apartheid would end, that you live to see that happen? And she said no. It seemed just unthinkable at the time. You know, you knew it was unjust, you knew it was unfair, you knew it was a shame, but you didn't think that there's anything that we could do about it. And then it ended, you know. it didn't end by divine intervention. It ended, again, by the struggle of the indigenous people of South Africa with the solidarity movement all around the world behind them. And eventually that was enough to reach a tipping point. Of course, the battle against Israeli apartheid is a lot more difficult for many different reasons. But we can also, we can do it. And I think it's worth for us saying that Palestine will be free, but also when we say it, to remember that it's not going to happen by divine intervention. It's going to happen if and only if we don't lose the motivation to wake up every day and ask, can I do a bit more today?
I mean, I guess I would say it's not just about obviously, I want to encourage, you know, I want everybody in this room to be able to come out of this meeting and remain motivated. It's not just, though, about end complicity. I mean, we have the highest crimes that mankind knows just committed in front of the world and was well documented. And so it's not just end the complicity. It also has to be let's have accountability. There needs to be justice. The people who committed these crimes need to be in jail. And that's not just the Israelis, it's their accomplices. 60 or 70 years ago when World War II happened or whatever, you know, we have research today that talked about the companies that made money off of the Holocaust. IBM, Chase Bank, whatever, Citibank, like, you know, there's been good research on that. But again, even that is not good enough for me, because it's not just about, it shouldn't just be about doing something about, you know, stopping the complicity of what happens to them, the Palestinians or us, or to defend basic principles of, you know, not allowing genocide to happen. But it should be about defending yourself. It should be about defending basic decency, defending your own country and values. Now, I'm sorry, that language can also be, you know, taken over by the right. But what do I mean here? I mean, you know, obviously we talked early on about how quickly liberal values, like, you know, sort of basic elements of liberal democratic praxis were taken away. And, you know, we shouldn't take for granted democracy anyway. It took hundreds of years to develop. Civil rights and right to protest and right to unionize, all those things had real struggles behind them, that where many people actually died to actually win those rights. And actually, the minute they're taken away, like what we saw, it's a threat to everybody. But the threat is much more, because obviously, you know, we witnessed what the Gaza genocide unleashed was these huge crimes. You were talking about, you know, using starvation as a weapon of war, you know, open genocide, right? And the technologies and the efficiency that we, and the methods of warfare that were unleashed by this genocide, if globalized, are horrific, okay? And that's not just about what happens if those things come back to Europe. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But imagine if that scenario goes to other parts of the world. What happens if it goes to the India, Pakistan? You could have 200, 300 million people dying in the next world war. The real key here is, when I talk about defending us, you know, I mean basically that we need to find a way to connect what happened in Gaza and in Palestine to our local domestic issues. Why is it important for Germans today here in this room? And to make that case convincingly, in the UK, there was a study done about AI and how AI has the potential to actually eliminate a third of jobs in the United Kingdom. A third job, when capitalism sees that a third of the jobs, a third of labor basically, and labor costs could go, they see dollar signs in their eyes. What we saw in the genocide is a kind of global genocide industry unleashed, that saw major profits in hydrocarbons and cybersecurity and weapons and in AI and in this big warfare that I sort of described as part of the Western project. Let's be honest, the West has been the dominant economic power since World War II, you know, and they want to keep that pole position. And geography and geopolitics and militarism is part of that, especially in a context where they don't have an economic policy. That there's no longer neoliberalism in the old sense. Okay, so the key for us today is to see how we can translate how and why the forces of the Gaza genocide, what happened in Gaza, are so dangerous for the world today and for the average working class person in Germany, I think. And in that regard, I think what do we do about it? What is to be done in the old classical lefto
yes.
question?
Yes.
Yeah, we have to try everything. We have to try the existing structures that existed to try and change policy, which include parliamentarism. We have to try extra parliamentary means. We need to try direct action. We need to try everything. And in this battle, information and research is going to be key. We need to know the sites and we need to map how and where Zionism exists and who made money off the Gaza genocide. There are people who made money off of that. I don't agree that the Israeli economy is falling apart. It's in the balance. It could do actually very well if they're successful. Why not? You know, it could be an entirely new global model, you know, where people are entirely eliminated. Big deal. They don't care. The people who are about to run the global economy and the people who pushed forward for the genocide are like the AI and you know, the Big Seven or whatever, the Marvelous Seven or whatnot. They're not Democrats. They don't believe in anything. We are in a massive geopolitical and new battleground, new paradigm. And that's why the left needs to step up. It needs to plan long-term for that. In the German context, translate to what it means for a place like Germany, particularly with its history and whatnot, and work slowly and effectively in a long-term struggle, but with a vision that the old order is over, basically, and that these forces have been unleashed and they're coming for us, basically. I mean, I know in Germany you guys have a lot of, you enjoy things like, you know, your privacy is important here, I guess.
They love it.
Supposedly. But that's all out the window. Yeah. I mean, they're looking for anywhere and everywhere where they can make profit and where they can control things. And that's what Gaza genocide showed, how those forces. We are in a moment like where over the summer I went and gave a whole bunch of talks. One of the talks I gave was called Gaza Guernica. Guernica was the battle in Spain between the partisans and the fascists, where Germany and Italian fascists together with Spanish fascists bombed the town of Guernica. It was considered a prelude to the battles that came in World War II. And basically, you know, everyone knows the big painting that Picasso did, but we are very much in that moment. A big battle is coming. A big battle is coming. Remember my words. A big battle is already here. So plan for it long term. And Germany has a key role in it. It is the engine of Europe. And the battle between what happens in the German working class and the German street versus the politicians on top, there's a lot of work to do here. So go about it systematically and try all the avenues that you can. We don't have time.
That was a very good, very motivating answer. So I appreciate, all three of you, thank you for taking my very bad, vague question and giving three very, very, very good, insightful, and powerful answers. Before we go to questions, just a very quick, thank you to our panel. Big round of applause from everyone. Thank you guys for coming out. And yeah, so questions. Who, all the way back there, really? Come up. You're gonna have to use my microphone, sorry.
Hey, my name is Ershak. I'm an Armenian activist, and I wanted to ask you whether you see any parallels between what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh in 2023 and also before in 2020, when like all these Israeli drones have been already used, and then the ethnic cleansing happened and all genocide happened, and now there are no Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, and like the genocide has been basically legitimized by this so-called peace deal that was brokered by Trump recently. And now we see how even the Armenian government, they are ready to drop the cases in international courts of justice, and they are also promoting this narrative of conflict while it was actually a genocide. And whether you see also parallels between like Israel and in general in Turkey, because like we know that the Armenian genocide, the first genocide happened, and until today, Armenians cannot return to the Armenian highlands and Anatolia in general. And yeah, what can be our response to that, this, since you talk about international solidarity and stuff like that? Thank you.
Who wants to take that one?
I mean, I think in a sense, you already kind of answered the question yourself very well. Like the parallels are there for you to see, right? Both in terms of the methods of genocide, but also the material connections in the case of Nagorno-Karabakh with the Israeli technology being used. And also the normalization and legitimization of it as well, and I think it only drives home the point further of these intersectional connections that we need to make, and intersectional coalitions that we need to build. You know, it's a system that threatens us all. The Armenian people know that very well, better than most people in the world. As do Palestinians, of course. So the connection is very evident there. So we need to build that and also bring it to other places that are in the firing lane, but are not necessarily there yet. But these are, and you know, I go back to your mention of the Israeli military equipment, because that's one key way in which these connections can be drawn in a very direct way. You see that in the Mediterranean as well. You know, the same companies that make the drones that kill Palestinians, that kill Armenians, are the drones, you know, made by the same company, sometimes the same model of drone, that are used to surveil and intentionally drown, because that's the policy really of the European Union, migrants in the Mediterranean. So yes, absolutely. And I think, look, now more than ever, with the geopolitical developments that we're seeing with the second Trump administration, that is really the number one priority. You know, we need to make sure that we're all fighting the same fight, and that we all understand that we're fighting the same fight.
I think I just want to add something to it. And the key thing here is, of course, there's parallels, but everything has their specificity. But there are parallels, and it's important to educate ourselves around this little corner of the globe where this happened and what happened. And there was a ethnic cleansing that took place there. I think the key here, though, is the fact that the story of what happened there did not really get out very far. Even, you know, which is unfortunate, because the principles are the same, right? In the case of the Gaza genocide, the principles, it became obvious and evident, and there is a historical opportunity to move around it so that it doesn't happen again, either in Armenia and in those areas, or in Gaza, or anywhere else. History, historical windows where it's possible to move open and then also shut. And they were very smallly open on the case of what was mentioned here. In Gaza, the window is open, much more open, you see. And that's why we can't allow it to shut, you see. It's not that one is better than the other, or one is more just than the other. There's obviously injustice everywhere, in many places. There's obviously horrific things happening in Sudan, in many other places. We're internationalists. We should be. So, but the point is, can we build a movement around it that will prevent that? And that's what we have now. That's what we can't lose. Do we have to go through another genocide somewhere else to be able to stop this? That's the question we need to be asking.
Yeah, okay. Come on, people in the back, really? All right, come forward, Phil. I guess one thing that while Phil's walking up, I mean, I am not on the expert of panels, but the thing I guess with Nagorno-Karabakh that I think is very interesting within it too, to like maybe put into perspective as well, is that then it kind of also served a very interesting episode for Turkey to then test out like the Bayraktar systems that were used in Ukraine that were quite cheap as well too. So there is also then the other aspect too of that military industry. Also Armenia's relationship with Russia, I think, could have also affected like why we didn't see so much of it in Western media and such. Just my own little two cents there, that it kind of like, it also like, we saw a lot of the technologies there being used then in Ukraine quite quickly. So that's, you know, NATO fun. Phil, you want your question?
Yeah. It's a question on Germany as well. And it's based on something which hasn't come up much, which is, it's only 3 months since the largest ever demonstration for Palestine in Germany. The 150,000 people, a large number of the tens of thousands, the white Germans who we said we would never win for Palestine. And I'm just, then 6 days later, there was the so-called ceasefire, which demobilized the movement worldwide, which made it more difficult. But I'm just thinking, when Tuvik's talking about windows of opportunity, we used to look at Poland and say, yeah, there's a window for opportunity over there, but never in Germany. And I'm wondering if there's a bit more hope. Unfortunately, our German speaker isn't here because he had a jogging accident. Get well soon, Hanno. But I wonder if any of the panels could speak for the Germans and say, is there hope here as well?
Speaking for the Germans, come on. Two, three foreigners. I cannot speak for the Germans, don't get me wrong, but what I do see is that it is way more normal. I live in a very white area in Germany, and like end of 23, beginning of 24, like when in Akufija, people were looking down. It was so difficult to organize things in Friedrichshain. It was really difficult. Nobody will give us a place. Sometimes they will, even if they give us a place, they will cancel the last minute because somebody has a complaint. And now that is all gone. Now it is okay to wear a kufiya. There are a lot of white people with kufiyas, and we have plenty of spaces to do stuff. So things are changing. Not at the speed that I would like or that Palestine needs, because it's like it's what Palestine needs. Things are changing, not quick enough. And in my opinion, it's a little bit, how would I say it without sounding too bad against Germans? That's not my forte. It's a little bit of a window. Now that it's okay to wear a kufiya, now that it's okay to be pro-Palestine because it's not that dangerous to be pro-Palestine as before. And these accusations of anti-Semitism now, they have lost their meaning. They overuse it. So now, like, either we are all anti-Semites or nobody is. Anyway, so now that it's okay, now is wearing a kufiya, they are going to more places. But where are they? Like when people get fired or other kinds of solidarity, I'm still missing them. And I would like I still go to the very few German parties that I'm still invited to after like breaking every single one of them for the last 2 years. Now I don't get kicked out. I get like, let's change the subject, but I don't get kicked out. And that's improvement. You know, right. Yeah. But I still miss this rage. And in my opinion, like I was thinking today, oh, what am I going to say here? And in Germany right now, the pro-Palestine movement, not the people in the BDS, but like we are more like on the streets, and then we are defending ourselves from the state and from the white Germans. And when I see like what happened in La Vuelta, because in Spain you don't have to explain to most of the Spanish people what is okay to be pro-Palestine, there is a lot more action happening. There are marches. The other day was Maccabees were going to play. They stopped it. They stopped La Vuelta. Most of the universities have stopped dealings with Israel. And this is what I'm missing here. Like, Germany is like decades behind the rest of the people, I will say. It's coming, but slowly. Yeah.
I want to also take the chance to second something that you said earlier, because the question was on window of opportunity. And to agree with the fact that I also think it's important to build coalitions within the working classes as well, in everywhere, and that includes Germany, and to explain to people how those things are also tied together. You know, it's not only the people also under the risk of suffering a genocide all over the world. It's primarily then, of course, it's first and foremost then, but also the marginalized and the working class more broadly everywhere. So we need to build those ties when we talk about rearmament in Europe, for instance. The fact that the German states now want you to work until you're 90 because there's money to be made at Heimetall, you know? We need to explain those, not only, you know, which is an easier task to explain why that's madness, why that's insane, why that leads to a worse world for you specifically, not just in general, but for your life, but also take the opportunity to draw the parallel. Oh, by the way, these companies that are trying to, you know, suck you dry and rob you of a future and your children of a future, essentially, they're the ones also making a killing, massacring Palestinians, you know, being complicit in that and many other things all over the world, many other human rights violations. So I think that's part of us also of the window of opportunity that we have here.
Remind me again of the question. I had something to say, but now I just lost it again.
I'm also blanking. 27th, yeah.
No, now I know what I want to say. Sorry. I think what we really, what's missing from this conversation a little bit is the fact that the ceasefire, after 2 years of mass mobilization, the global north was actually... The mass protest movements were reaching it. They called the ceasefire by, if it was up to Israel, they would still be doing finishing the job, right? Basically, if you remember when the ceasefire was called, Israel was saying, we're about to enter Gaza City, we're going to wipe out the city, etc., and with the intention to push people even further down and to continue the ethnic cleansing process but what was really happening was you had a general strike that reached Italy. You had general strikes in Barcelona. They were also parts of Greece. I was in a demonstration it wasn't just in the south of Europe. It was beginning to go north. And it got to 150,000 people in Germany, 250,000 in Amsterdam. And obviously the UK had massive ones as well. Okay, that is not something small. Okay, because when I talked in my previous answer about connecting it to the working class, when you have a general strike, you show the power of people. They can stop the system. That is actually the power of people. It's not just that you won't buy Coca-Cola or you don't buy, you know, a weapon or whatnot. It's actually you withhold your labor from the system. That is the power of the working class. Okay, that is ultimately your power under capitalism. Okay, and the more you have that organized, the more you have that politicized, the more you have that directing political priorities, the more you will be able to have political power. And that's what it's about.
So they actually pulled the plug on Netanyahu from doing his psycho plan to continue going after Gaza, et cetera, in a plan that they were not convinced was even possible. And I don't think it was possible, actually. I mean, they would not, it would have gone on indefinitely. There are 700 kilometers worth of tunnels underneath Gaza that they were, that according to the Israelis, 80% of them were still active. They did not find any of the hostages themselves or whatnot. All the, there was one case of it, whatnot. So the point is the Americans were unconvinced of the Israeli plan, and their own backyard, the West, was about to come, the wheels of the project were about to come off because the contradictions of what they were doing were so extreme, and they were undermining liberalism so much. And in the West, where liberalism is in the in America, liberalism is a lot more weak. But here, it's there's still a balance, a post-war balance between capital and labor and expectations around social welfare, etc. Now, the plan of what's coming up is they want to use, you know, this new global economic crisis, basically, to... They don't have an economic plan. They needed Israel. They need to keep China back. They still need America as their sort of NATO partner, whatnot. They're pushing now military industrial Keynesianism in the heart of Europe, which and when Trump goes on TV and he says Europe is going down the wrong way because they're still tolerating. So you know they have they have social democracy here. They still have. They accepted a lot of immigrants. There's a social contract here that is still needs to be respected. And that's the point. We need to respect it. We need to double it down. And we need to organize that political power to stop genocide and to protect and defend what we have already won and work to advance it and widen it. Because the forces that are coming against us are trying to reduce that and to unleash genocide and just a brutal form of capitalist vulture capitalism and militarism and military Keynesianism, which is going to change the priorities of our system and are going to fundamentally change the way of life that you have here. So, okay, that's enough. That's the point made. You get it.
I think we're time, because it is almost 9 o'clock. Sorry if anyone else had some urgent questions. I'm sure you can ask outside. Thank you all so much for coming on. I would normally do the podcast thing of where can people find you, but I'll put that all in the description. Thank you to the audience for being so lovely and a little bit too quiet, but you know, that's fine. I say that's an evening. We can, if they're still open upstairs, we can grab another drink, hang out, do that whole thing. And just a big thank you once again to the panel and to you, our audience, for coming out.